Hi, welcome back to another episode of Real World Serverless, a podcast where I speak with real world practitioners and get their stories from the trenches. Today, I'm joined by Bob Hennant, who is a principal architect at The Zone. Hey, Bob, good to have you here.
Nice to be here, yeah.
So I used to work at The Zone around the same time as you, but you've been there for a lot longer than me. And you were working on the video streaming side of things, which for me was always a bit of a black box because we kind of just know, you know, building these APIs, we're surfacing these video streams, but we don't really know how pictures got from the pitch all the way to, say, CloudFront distributions or other CDNs. And that sort of things is also pretty crazy when it comes to, when you think about the kind of scale that The Zone is running at with millions of concurrent viewers. So there must be some pretty amazing challenges that you have to deal with there. So before we get into that, do you want to just quickly introduce yourself and The Zone and, what do you do there?
Yeah, so I'm principal architect now at The Zone. When you knew me, I was a video architect, and now I have a wider remit, although I tend to focus on infrastructure technologies, both cloud compute and physical infrastructure, but still doing a lot on content security, so DRM and anti-piracy measures. I even have to do legal, patent, and regulatory oversight, which is interesting, and an area that not a lot of engineers. I tend to seem to do these things that other engineers don't do. Who does content security? Who does patents? Who does government regulatory? And how many programmers these days want to get into actual low level infrastructure? It's not that many. Yeah, I have over 20 years in the media tech industry. Been a technologist. I did a decade in consumer electronics as well, for big name brands there. And I've also been ex-BBC, Norwegian Telecom, and TalkTalk TV, various other different places. But yeah, now I've been at The Zone since 2017. I've been there from when it was really small, just a couple of countries we were in before, and then seen it all the way to now where we're worldwide, dealing with millions of subscribers and in doing thousands of events per week.
Yeah, I remember even when I joined, I think it was 2018, it was still quite a small operation. There were not that many engineers, at least not in the building in London. When we had to hire, I think it was hundreds of engineers in the space of like 2 years. But for all that, the people that were still just working on the API side of things, I've always heard a bit of a murmur about the stuff that's happening in the video stream side of things, some of the challenges that comes with that. And when you've got right now with millions of concurrent viewers, that must be some pretty interesting scalability challenges. Can you maybe talk briefly, at least on a high level, what kind of scale that The Zone is running at and what kind of problems that comes with that?
Yeah, I won't divulge any company numbers around what we can. There are some public stuff done, but I wouldn't want to try and remember the exact numbers that we've published. We're a privately owned organization, so we don't do that, but we don't have to do that. It's interesting because we have over 100 sports rights, and anything from competitive lumberjacking and competitive fishing to the hottest thing. So we've got the NFL national football in the USA, but we cover the rest of the world. So we run NFL Game Pass International on behalf of the NFL. We have the Italian Serie A, and Italians are fanatical about their football. We have Serie A, I think also Serie B, and other content. We have Japan J-League, J-League 1, 2, and 3. We have a significant amount of sports in Spain. We also have the decent impact in the DACH region, in Germany, Austria, and Switzerland. And then we have our fight sports as well. So we do both subscription-based match coverage, which is very extensive across a wide range of fight sports. And then we now do pay-per-view boxing as well, which has been an interesting shift for us, moving from a pure subscription. And then I think recently we're also currently launching the free-to-view as well. So people can just sign up and watch a selection of content. We've been a big advocate of women's sport, which has seen massive increases in audience since we've been able to provide more coverage rather than just a match here and a match there. We provide regular coverage of women's football in particular. We started mostly doing event-based. So the model was everything is about the events. But then we got more and more demand for having what we call linear channels, which is like what you'd be traditionally familiar with. We do some of those syndicated out to partners like internet service providers or cable TV companies or satellite TV companies. and some of them we just run on our platform because some people just want to turn on and watch something. They're not, so we do these thematic channels where somebody can watch something of a particular theme and it will just carry on through. Or you can log into the app and watch live events, or you can watch catch up of a whole range of sports, whatever somebody happens to be interested in. And when you go from something like competitive lumberjacking, the audience can be quite small. It's passionate and it's interesting to those people, and you know, it can capture an interesting audience. But when you go from that to something as big as a Super Bowl or a local derby in Italy for football, that can, you know, the disparity and the changes you have to go through. We say, like, during the middle of the week, the consumption is relatively, you know, the baseline consumption, our baseline to peak is huge. The differences in what you can see, you know, going from relatively modest numbers and then scaling over 1,000 times to the weekend can be a challenge, because you're not, how do you plan for that level of compute change? And also, unlike, say, a traditional video on demand provider like, say, Netflix or Amazon, people, if you release a new episode of a program, say, you know, this is the old Game of Thrones effect or whatever we want to go for as being the current thing now, they can take a piece of content and they can pre-seed it out to their CDNs before they've made it available to, before they've made the listing available. We can't do that because we could do it for VOD, but VOD is not the most significant part of our traffic. The real heart of our traffic is the live consumption, and people will turn on to watch the game at the time that it's starting. So your ramp up volumes and your scaling, and you probably maybe even remember that, the scaling challenges, auto scaling doesn't always work. And if you, unless you put very aggressive pre-scaling in before, so you have to know what your game is going to do. You have to have an idea that we have analysts running numbers to figure out how many people are going to watch a particular game. And then we will make sure that we go into the weekend or go into that evening or that afternoon having everyone ready for that thing. And you'll remember the readiness calls where, are we going to turn up this? Are we going to suspend doing this process? You know, are we going to make sure that we don't have any resource contention? All of that kind of stuff you have to be really careful of. And the other thing is that in live, efficiencies can go out of the window as well. So a traditional CDN distribution you'll get a much different ratio of cache efficiency through the CDN in file delivery versus live streaming delivery. Because when people are asking for that file, it is better distributed through the CDN network. Whereas in live streaming delivery, everyone is asking for the same segment at the same time because they're all watching at the same time. So you can imagine the race conditions are horrible. You can imagine, and you're talking about terabits per seconds of requests. Now, we can be in large numbers of terabits per second of requests. Now, I don't think I can say exactly, but you know, we're talking more than single digit terabits per seconds worth of requests in a single country. How do you deal with that race condition where at the edge all the requests are coming in for the same file at the same second, even sub-second level requests, because we actually NTP sync all of the clients on playback. So the clients all know exactly what the time is. So you can see that would be a horrible efficiency problem to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, it's surprising how the CDNs even deal with things like this. You know, you got these really small files. As soon as it hits in one location, guests have to be distributed to all the locations almost instantly, because Everyone is, like you said, is looking for that same segment to enable the playback for the next 5 seconds of footage.
And that's where we use that's where multi-CDN really comes in, because when we go into a season and in a week, so we'll do pre-analysis for the season, but we'll also do every week or every 2 weeks, we'll be planning what's coming up. And that what's coming up will inform, we'll talk to the CDNs themselves, and we have great account managers and folk at the CDNs, and we'll pre-warn them. We'll say, this is coming up, that's coming up, you know, this is going to be a big weekend. We know it's going to be a big weekend. And they will tell us, and they're instructed to tell us, can you do it? We will give you this much concurrency. Can you handle it? If you can't handle it, tell us, and we'll put more traffic elsewhere. And if they're dishonest and they say, oh, you know, then their metrics will fall, and we'll hold them accountable to their metrics about throughput and about failures and stuff like that. So we have a complex measurement system that it comprehensively measures every single customer's quality of experience on their stream, and then that gets reported to our live operations team, who are constantly watching for little movements in the graph. And if there's a request errors, or if the high definition rates is what we call, so what percentage of the audience is watching HD, and if the HD rate starts to fall, that's a bad sign, because it means that we're saturating the network. And then, so we can say, oh, okay, that vendor is going to get 40% of the traffic, and that vendor is going to get 20% of the traffic, and that vendor is going to get another 20% of the traffic, and balance out who's going to get what, and somebody else is going to deal with that. And that means that you can go into a season, or go into a week, or a weekend, or even a day, knowing that you should have enough capacity to run the event.
Yeah, I remember that when I was watching live stream, sometimes the video quality degrades for maybe, you know, a few seconds or a few minutes, and then it comes back. I guess that's what you were talking about, right? The CDN's throughput has been saturated. And I remember talking to some of the guys, I think like Max, who was working on the front end, doing a lot of the video player side of things. There's also some, I think it was dynamic quality control, so that you know, as it sees the bit rate drops, they automatically, on the front end, the client will automatically, I think, switch to maybe a different CDN or switch to a different bit rate or file stream, so that it fetch them at a lower bit rate. Is that something that I guess maybe that the question would be, what are some of the mechanisms that we have there to protect the user experience? make sure that the user gets the best experience possible?
Yeah, so the first thing you've got is a certain degree of buffering. And buffering logic is kind of the, as we refer to it as the magic sauce. That's one of the reasons why we've moved a lot of our devices away from the more popular players, the media players, to our own formula. And that's because we want to control the buffering logic and the retry logic and the kind of request processing function is really that can, and we're talking about shaving percents, because you want to make sure that every customer is experiencing it perfectly. And that can mean getting a percent here and a benefit there and a percent benefit there, because that single percent can be, 10,000 people's experience. So what it does is a stream, if in most cases today, from anybody who's doing mass delivery, is just a series of file chunks. And we encode 5, 6, 8, 10 different versions of the stream, and then they're all time aligned, so you can switch between the different levels. And if we have problems with that fetching and we can see that there's a problem with the stream, we can move up and down. And a temporary glitch in quality will probably be something a bit more local to you rather than a regional effect. But the point at which it can then also switch CDN. If it's seeing that the CDN is really not performing, or we've got a request error or something like that, don't bother retrying. We call it rotating, because you've got a list of CDNs that you can use, and then you just rotate to the next one, and then rotate to the next one, and then rotate to the next one, because you're aiming to try and give the best experience possible. But we also, for resilience purposes, we don't just have one origin, we call it the origin of the stream. We have multiple, and we have two origins that are identical, so an A and a B. And it's not done, it's done hot, and that hot arrangement, they're not perfectly synchronous to each other. They're pretty synchronous, but basically you can't do them as kind of an invisible A-B switch currently. That's very hard to do with video encoding at a cloud scale. It used to be a lot easier on-prem, but in cloud distributions, maintaining sub-second accuracy of synchronization in video is very, very hard. So we can, if one of the origins fails, you can flip over to the other origin, and then we have another origin, which is kind of our fallback origin, and then we have a disaster recovery origin as well. And yeah, we have a whole series of, because we cannot fail, we must have 100% availability wherever possible. It's expected from us by our rights holders and by our customers who are passionate. The customers can't come back later to watch the game, not as far as they're concerned. So whereas you might choose, if you fail to load something on a video on demand service and it failed to load, you just go, I'll watch something else. I'm a bit disappointed, I'll watch something else. A football fan or a sports fan is going to be a lot more upset if they can't watch the game.
Yeah, I can imagine. You watch a game for 90 minutes and then the goal goes in, that's a 2 second segment of that 90 minutes. And everyone kind of just, they go in there to watch a live event. It needs to be available and ready. And I remember sometimes I do remember seeing sometimes, I don't know if it's the stream switching happening behind the scenes, but you do see, okay, sometimes that the frame would jump, but you can always just, go back 5 seconds and you can catch the last 5 seconds anyway. I do remember seeing sometimes that there's some like the frames just jumping. I don't know if it's because of the switching streams behind the scenes.
We're now so close that you probably wouldn't notice. We just can't call them perfect.
Perfect. But that's pretty amazing in terms of the technologies that need to go into it to enable that. So you mentioned this like the four different streams, but are they all coming from the same? I guess the same cameras on the pitch that the so I guess maybe we can we talk about how the pictures, how the videos go from the pitch side cameras to the cloud distributions or just different CDN distributions?
Yeah. Maybe what I'll do is I'll kind of work backwards because we've already gone to the CDN. So the CDN is doing our segment distribution, right, which is just chunks of video. The head end consists of three components. There's an origin cache, which is just a Nginx or Varnish cache. There's a thing called a packager. The packager creates it in a format that your player, your device expects. And because Apple, Google, Microsoft, and the others couldn't necessarily all agree on using same standard, Apple has their format. Everyone else has their format. We also apply the encryption at that point. DRM is just AES encryption. It's a block cipher, continuous block cipher. The secret of DRM is in the key exchange, not in the packager or anything like that. So the packager is making it in a format that you expect. And then the encoder sits before the packager. And the encoder kind of does what you'd expect. It produces the eight steps on what we call the ladder. You can step up eight different video qualities and two different audio qualities. Before that, our encoding is all done in the cloud because actually, scaling from, say 3 or 4 events in the middle of the week to 60, 70 events at the weekend. And these compute instances are very big. So, you know, you're talking large number XL encoders. And so we have had incidents before where you have to kind of tell Amazon how many machines you're going to need because they're going to be worried if they run out of compute. It is possible. I can tell you, it is possible to make AWS run out of compute, at least in a particular instance classes in particular locations. But I think people are a bit surprised that you can actually make AWS run out of compute.
Pretty crazy. You guys are stretching the limit, the capabilities of AWS and CDN providers.
Yep. We can do a lot of damage if we're not careful. You've got to get the signals to the cloud. So we have data centers in around London, two sets of those which handle the video before it goes to the cloud. You could do all of this in the cloud. It's a little bit more, in some ways, a little bit more challenging. If you started from the scratch doing it, as cloud native, you could do it easier in different ways. But we have a global WAN, which is a private WAN, which allows us to move video without any network effects. So we can guarantee that we can get high quality, very high quality video all around the world whenever we need it. So the main kind of what we call transmission, which is a bit of a legacy term, but the transmission compute infrastructure will come through London. Our main broadcast transmission facility is in Leeds in the north of England, and there's a backup facility in Northern Ireland. And then there are regional production centers located around the world that collect together. So, you know, there's a major center in Japan, you've got Munich, Milan, various different places, Madrid, where we will put stuff together, collect the events, things like that. But it tends to all come landing back through London, controlled by teams in Leeds and Northern Ireland. And In what you're doing in transmission is you are you're making sure that whatever you're receiving, you know, wherever it's coming from in the world, you're making sure that you always have output. Because you can lose the signal because it's coming in from, you know, coming in from so many different places. You can lose the video source, and you know, whoever's done streaming, you know, you've experienced that situation where somebody drops out, something like that. If you just put the stadium connected directly to the cloud encoders, what would you do if something went wrong? But also, how do you insert ads? How ads are a revenue source, and I won't dwell on what people think one way or the other, but you know, we have to have processes to insert ads. But also, we're not the only one who consumes these feeds. So whether we had ads or not, we'd have to cover the break. So there's a break in play. We have to fill that with something. We also fill it with like mini documentaries and stuff like that. So that has to go through a process we call play out, which is inserting some ads, inserting other interstitial content, we call it, which is something that's not an ad, but is something that you might enjoy watching. And also cover. And cover is when things go wrong, because we might lose a feed from a stadium. We might have a match disrupted for some reason. And, you know, if it's rain in tennis, what are you going to do? You can just show the tennis court for 2 hours while they're waiting for the rain to stop, or you can put something else up. And so that's the kind of play out component of transmission. There's a thing called MCR, Master Control Room. And MCR's job is to make sure that it's leaving TX, not manage TX themselves. TX is a separate team who are making sure that their event is working. But once it leaves TX, it's now MCR's responsibility going up to the cloud. And then MCR is also making sure that the signals are arriving. And we have so many different stadiums around the world and venues around the world. And, you know, it could be from a satellite truck in the Sudan, or not Sudan, probably, I don't know, somewhere. It could be in a satellite truck in Africa if it's one of the races across the desert or something like that. Or it could be Las Vegas casino. It could be a football stadium, but it also might not be coming only to us. It might be going to multiple broadcasters. So we're just one of the consumers of it. It might be dedicated to us, or we might be the host broadcaster. We might own the right to it in the case of, say, many of the boxing matches we do. And then we've not only got to send it to ourselves, we've also got to send it out to all of our syndicated partners. So MCR provides a really solid kind of nexus point for everything that's coming in and out of the zone, whether it be a fully prepared stream or whether it be something that's coming in a bit rough and needs to be treated and then and syndicated on, something like that. So we have a lot of complicated switching and processing of high quality video streams. And, you know, we're talking anything from 3 gigabits per second over IP to 45 or 15 megabits, some of it. But it can go, it can, I mean, and, yeah, 3 gigabits per second IP video, uncompressed, is quite meaty.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't realize how much physical infrastructure and human infrastructure have to be put in place for things like that to happen. Because I do know that a lot of the football, certainly in the Premier League, they have all these video cameras. All of that are owned by the team and the stadium, and then they send it to broadcasters who has the rights. In this case, it would be the Zone or maybe Sky Sports or somebody else. And then I guess I imagine that the MCRs would be people with all these different camera angles, and that they are doing the button switching to say, okay, now put the ads on now, or to do something, or to show the replay for the last for the goal for the last 10 seconds. And then I guess only at that point then the data started getting sent to our data centers to the cloud to do the video encoding, and then. Okay, and then that goes to the CDN providers, to the multiple CDN providers.
Yeah, and there's a lot multiple layers of treatment that go on. So we very rarely would have something where we would look at multiple angles at the MCR or TX level. That would be more done at the stadium. So at the stadium, you've got all the cameras there. They go to a truck, which has Vision Mixer, which is a big desk with so the famous thing is the in the Death Star, when he pulls the lever forward to fire the Death Star, if you go Google that right now, you will see that's a Grass Valley mixing desk, okay. For TV, that's called a Vision Mixer, and somebody used that, whatever it was, £500,000 mixer they must have rented or something like that, because it looked cool. Just a whole load of buttons where you've got all of your sources going in and out. That's what will happen at the truck, and then a prepared version of that comes out of the truck, and it comes either via satellite or via fiber or via diverse fibers. So you've got to make sure you have two different fibers going via two different routes that never cross each other anywhere in the world, which can be a challenge, because what you don't want is some digger to cut through the fiber and you lose it. So you have to plan all these things, like, what's my diverse fiber route? And then I've got my fiber optics, which is my high quality from the stadium. And then maybe if it's a really critical event, I've also got a satellite truck to bring it back to me. Or if I can't get fiber, then I'll use it via satellite. But I have to, the satellite link isn't always the highest quality compared to fiber. So you've got a little bit of a balance there. And then when it gets to us, what we're doing is kind of finishing it off. Making it that little bit, last bit of DAZN polish on top of something that was probably quite generic for multiple broadcasters around the world. And there is a thing called remote production, which we've done some work on. It's not the most common thing in the world at the moment, because actually you need things like 40 gigabit links from stadiums and stuff like that, which can be challenging.
Do you guys use Elemental and things like that? Because I thought the Elemental was supposed to also be able to get you that access to live video streams from cameras on a pitch and things like that.
Yeah, so we use our main head end, what you could consider to be our main head end at the moment, our main origin, uses Elemental Media Live as the encoder, and that can have multiple sources in it, but controlling that to do all of the prettiness that we want for the high-end matches, it's not the best control surface to do that with. We have some very nice tools that allow us to kind of manage the flow of the show as it goes through. And so before the show starts, it will put some nice animations up, and then it will do nice transition into the pre-match stuff, and then it will insert the markers for the ads. And then if you have an issue, you've kind of got these pre-made macros that you can bring up, and it's like a touch surface. So you've got you're just using a touch screen control to kind of do what you want to do next, rather than having to kind of Elemental is a bit more of a raw tool, and a little bit simple for the richness of features. And Elemental gets better every year in terms of its capabilities. But as a playout surface, it's, I think even they would admit, it's not up there with the best playout systems that you can get. And we do have some of the best playout systems you can get to give our the best experience we can do.
And I also note that the Zone does a lot of its own commentaries. It's got its own commentary team. In fact, I remember someone telling me in Germany that a lot of people watch the Zone because they really like the guy that does the football commentaries for Bundesliga. So does that bit happen in the MCR, or does that happen before or after that?
So sometimes you'll get commentary that comes from on the incoming feed. So that might be a game that we've, or an event that we're running in the, but a lot of the time, what happens is we get the world feed, which is what we call, you know, it's the generic version that has the stadium atmospheric sound, but has no commentary. And that arrives with us at the MCR, and then they will link in over IP links, a commentator who is sitting in a room somewhere in the world. We have these commentator booths which people can sit in, and they have headphones and a monitor and microphone and all that kind of thing. And then they see an ultra low latency version of our stream, and then they're commenting on that, and then that gets sent. The audio from them gets sent back and then remixed within the stream. And the good thing about audio is that audio encoding takes very little time. So from the time it takes to send that signal to Munich to a commentator for them to commentate on it and then get back to us is just a fraction of a second. So it doesn't really introduce any overhead for us. But it means that we can mix in commentators anywhere in the world. So, you know, we could have a German Bundesliga match commentated by somebody in Japan, just because we can do that. You know, we can create in any language we see fit to well, anything that makes commercial sense for us to provide a commentator for.
Yeah, I guess that makes some of the localization experience a lot better, because you can have someone, like you said, commentating in Japan in Japanese and showing a Japanese commentated the stream to the Japanese audience.
Yeah, and we've had occasions where there's been a Japanese player who's been very popular in Europe. There's been a Japanese player who's playing for a big European team. And that creates a great deal of interest. And so we end up having a large audience for European football in Japan. And so it deserves that little bit more treatment than just if we were going to say, you know, there's a niche audience or they can watch it in German or English. Because, well, you know, hiring a commentator to commentate for those games for a small audience might not be justified, but if there's a decent size audience, then creating a local version can be an advantage.
Okay, so, you know, quite a few things you've talked about so far, kind of, you know, you've got this really this resilience architecture whereby everything has got like a fallback. You've got your fallback on CDNs, you've got your fallback on the fiber optic cables, and then we also have fallbacks on the front end as well as on the back end side of things. You know, resilience, when we're looking at the zones coming up, the engineering principles, resilience was like number one, pretty much above all else. Number two was scalability. So what are some of the, I mean, building systems with this kind of level of resilience to make sure that when the live event is happening, you have to be 100% up? What are some of the biggest lessons that you've learned about that? And what are some of the biggest challenges that comes up when you have to, you know, think about, you know, really high number of uptime?
I would say that you have to be careful as to what you've got. economy of scale as well, because you can, as you move from one part of, you know, one stage of your business to another stage of the business, the what costs you money can change. And a lot of engineers aren't particularly exposed to the cost implications or the overheads that their decisions make. And, you know, we're deciding that because you're part of the project needs to store some data, that you're going to spin up a database. Have you thought about the consequences of that? That's creating a whole new instance. And it's easy to go from having, you know, some instances or to sit in your domain, and then that problem can kind of balloon, and then you're thinking about, you know, what's impacting my resources and what's costing me, but also compute efficiency can start to play a big factor, because if I'm thinking about what it was taking to run a function at one scale, but then does that make sense when I'm suddenly going from 10,000 to over a million concurrent requests, or not concurrent requests, but a million concurrent users, the decision levels that you need to take, because actually the execution time of your code can really make a decision. And we've also had stuff, interestingly, around the use of ALBs versus NLBs, and because you can hit limits, you think, oh, you know, well, Amazon's providing a service, it's got to be unlimited. No, there are limits to what you can actually request in on certain services, and there are patterns that you need to talk to experts and talk to either Amazon themselves or people who've got experience when you're saying, why can't I get the most out of this? Because I'm suddenly realizing that I'm saturating it. And it can be quite funny when you're sitting there and you're going, oh, I can't just do that. I reach a that. Oh, what do I do? I don't know. I need to do something different. I need to completely change the way that load balancing works, or I need to change the way that auto scaling works, or I need to rewrite my code from TypeScript into Rust or Go or something else that is more compute efficient. Do I want to not run some? I designed something because I thought serverless Lambda was going to be perfect, but actually I can't do that in Lambda because I can't get enough Lambda execution time available to me, so I actually have to run it as a containerized solution instead, because I need it to be heavier, and I can get a little bit more performance, a little bit more performance and cost effectiveness out of running it as a container, maybe at a certain scale. And the other one is I'm doing a lot of work on proper edge compute, and I have to be really careful because I'm doing that on CDNs. And if I do edge compute on the CDN, is that taking away from the number of hundreds of gigabits per second I can deliver on each node? And, is that going to negatively affect customer experience, even though I'm doing something necessary around, you know, I've done some work on advanced tokenization at the edge lately. And, you know, worrying about the execution time and how long does it take to calculate a hash? How many hashes can I have in this token before we run out of compute execution time at the edge? Can be quite fine-grained problems. It's like optimizing the Linux kernel or something like that. It can be quite a problem that you're trying to solve.
Yeah, certainly the kind of problems you run up you come up against when you're running a scale is very different. I remember when we first started talking about this, you talk about how the big up ramp in terms of the traffic, because everybody logs in at the same time, and on the API side of things, yeah, we saw a lot of that, and it was one of the reasons that we actually ran into some of the burst capacity limits on Lambda. So you know, we couldn't use the Lambda for most of the APIs on that critical path of somebody logging in and start watching a stream, because your traffic would go from a few hundred, maybe, I don't know, whatever, request hundreds, no, some reasonable baseline, to suddenly 100x in the minute, in a minute, or maybe 2 minutes time window.
My best we had an API, which I won't say which API it was, but it was getting 500 RPS, and then something happened with the stream that caused every front end device to make a call. And we went from 500 RPS to 60,000 RPS in the space of under 5 seconds.
Yeah. That can happen when you've got millions of concurrent users.
And the ability of streaming to create stampedes is something that I don't think people experience in other, you know, there's the, what do you call it, the Hacker News effect, that kind of thing. No, that's gentle compared to what we can do when we have something that causes a small glitch in the player, which then causes an API request from 100,000 or a million users at once. And it's because it's video, it's time aligned.
Yeah. And I guess also one of the challenges also is that a lot of the time, because it's, you know, you're serving live content, a lot of things may not be as cacheable as you would be otherwise. And also because the requests all come, you know, exactly at the same time, maybe you haven't had a chance to cache that previous request before you handle the next one.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of challenges that makes some of the, I guess, more traditional, you know, web traffic patterns and the best practices make it quite hard to apply in this particular situation.
Yeah,
I know that from the API side of
entitlement checks, cryptographic functions for handing out keys, they're all really tough.
Yeah, things that seems simple in pretty much every single other use case suddenly becomes a potential problem that's going to trip you up. But yeah, it's at the same time, it's one of the more interesting things that I've ever worked on. Some of the challenges that really makes you think much deeper in terms of, okay, every decision you're making, there's a small change can have a big cost impact, and small change can have also have a big impact on your uptime as well.
Yeah.
Which as we talked about is number one for the zone engineering.
And having in excess of 30 different players, you know, you've got multiple different Android apps, your Android TV apps, you've got different platforms you're distributing to, you've got every smart TV in the world that you're trying to address. It means that any single change to a front-end API has to be really carefully thought through, really, and the rollout strategies can also be quite challenging. To say, I've got to put this feature in. I need to make this change. How do I identify? How do I target? How do I get the teams? Is it a platform that's depreciated? Is it a platform that we're struggling to get developers' time on? Those sorts of things can be really painful for feature releases or security patching, not patching as much as like security features and things like that, which is something I'm responsible for. So yeah, there can be a lot of different challenges.
And I remember there was also setup boxes. Some of them are running, they don't even run the standard HTML. They've got like custom implementation of HTML. So there's things like that, which I remember some of the front end teams was always have to be quite careful about in terms of code changes.
No EME, MSE.
Yeah, that's
none
it.
None of that. You've got native API. Some of them aren't even yeah, they're running different things like CEHTML.
Okay.
Who's heard of CEHTML apart from a few people in the media industry? And then you've got things like Roku, which has its own magical script called BrightScript, which is nobody else uses that. it can be quite weird.
In that case, what would you say is that the number one biggest lesson you've learned from your time with DAZN?
I suppose that it's the kind of impact blast radius of decisions. You need to really think about that, and also the experience in scaling can bring up surprises that you didn't really expect. In order to maintain that kind of high level, high quality, high demand, coping with all that demand, and also changing fast, the experience of rapid growth of a business, and to be able to capture so much in just a few years, there are businesses that their customer base scales quite rapidly. But I don't think there are businesses that grow both in their breadth and their demand at the same time to that degree where you end up offering, 10 times more than you did before, while also delivering to, n times many customers. That kind of growth, I think, just if it was just dealing with a massive growth of customers, that would be a different problem to also at the same time trying to offer a wider breadth to customers. It's been a challenge, and it's been a fulfilling thing to work with great people as well in DAZN on making something that I don't think a lot of other people have experienced. So it's been really good to kind of deal with those challenges as well.
Yeah, it's definitely been one of the best teams that I've worked with. Some really, really smart people, people that are still keeping in touch with, like Luca, who's doing amazingly well at the AWS. Bob, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. I'm really glad that more people have heard about some of the things that some of the magic that you guys have been working on the video side of things. I've learned a lot myself as well. So thank you so much for that.
Thank you for having me on. It's been a good time.
Yeah, and the best of luck. I'm still I'm still enjoying my DAZN account and watching football match every now and then.
Great.
Thanks for the good work.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Okay, take easy, guys. Okay, bye bye. So that's it for another episode of Real World Serverless. To access the show notes, please go to realworldserverless.com. If you want to learn how to build production-ready serverless applications, please check out my upcoming courses at productionreadyserverless.com. And I'll see you guys next time.